Underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester, Vermont, and Saratoga, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a master's degree in English with a concentration in literature studies and an MFA in creative writing. strose.edu/gradprograms.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Lydia Davis is renowned in literary circles for perfecting the craft of the extremely short story. She is the winner of the 2013 Man Booker International Prize, one of the world literature's most prestigious prizes. Davis is a short story author, New York State Writers Institute Writing Fellow, and UAlbany English Department faculty member. Her latest collection is Can't and Won't. It is published by FSG, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Lydia Davis to this week's book show. Thank you so much for being with us. A delight.
It's a pleasure.
Tell us how you come to put a collection together. It takes you several years to be able to put a collection together.
Yes, it happens over time, and I'm not deliberately thinking ahead to the collection, to the finished book at all. During those few years, I'm simply writing one story after another and concentrating just on that one story at a time. And after a while, I realize, well, I have quite a few stories now. Perhaps I can begin to think about putting them together in a book. So it happens that way. Then organizing the book is another matter. That's often quite difficult, especially in the case of this one, where there were, I think, 122 stories or so. So it's very hard to figure out. You don't want to just pile them into the book. You have to figure out some sort of logical order.
When you figure out that you have enough to bring into a collection, do you realize that there perhaps has been a theme or themes that run through the stories that perhaps help in the collection and the distribution of them within the book?
Yes, in earlier collections, it was not quite as obvious, but I would begin to notice, oh, there are a lot of stories about arguing here. Maybe I should, in fact, leave some of them out because it might get a little too heavy. In this case, I had actually been doing sort of groups of stories over time, dream stories and stories taken from Flaubert's letters and letters of complaint that I had written. So there were actual categories of stories that did make it easier.
When you have a category like that, of whether it be Flaubert or dreams, are those stories written at the same time? Are they written in a succession, or is it still fairly random?
In the case of those categories, they were written more or less in succession. I mean, there would be other stories I would write in between or during that project, but I would get alert for dream material, for example, and so I would be deliberately looking for more material for another dream story or finding another good story in the Flaubert letters. So they were written more sequentially, yeah.
In deliberately looking for material, especially when it comes to dreams, is it about your dreams or is it about dreams in general?
It's really about anything that will lend itself to being told like a dream. So some of them are actual dreams of mine. Some are dreams of friends. Some are not dreams at all, but experiences in waking life that are like dreams and can be told like dreams. So that's really what interests me, that blurry dividing line between a strange everyday experience or daily life experience and a more ordinary dream, not quite so strange dream that could be almost a waking experience.
You are nice enough to, throughout our program today, of read us some of the stories from the collection Can't and Won't. And I'm hoping you can begin by reading the title story, Can't and Won't, which in some way is the jacket of the book.
Yes, it is. Most of it is.
Most of it is.
Yes, I'd be happy to. can't and won't. I was recently denied a writing prize because they said I was lazy. What they meant by lazy was that I used too many contractions. For instance, I would not write out in full the words cannot and will not, but instead contracted them to can't and won't.
And that actually happened as far as being denied a prize?
No, that would have been very funny, but what actually happened was that I dreamt this, and so it could have been one of the dream pieces, but it felt much more like a different sort of story. It didn't feel like a dream story. So
while we were on the subject of literary prizes, what did the Man Booker Prize mean to you?
Oh, it was very exciting, really, because it was exciting to find out I'd been nominated. And the way they do it is they invite you to a dinner in London, which, of course, is quite far away, to hear whether you've actually won it or not. And I have always other reasons to go to London, so I decided that would be quite fun and quite interesting. But I really didn't expect to win it because the stories are kind of quirky and odd. Usually I don't think you can get judges to come to a consensus that these odd little stories are worthy of a prize. So I thought, well, it's fine to be nominated, and then the prize will go to someone who's written a good solid novel, you know. And there I was at the dinner and just having a good time and more or less forgetting all about what was going to happen later in the evening. And then the judge walked up to the podium, and I have to say that a dinner partner to my right, someone I was seated next to who was in the know, knew ahead of time, and I muttered to him, well, here comes the hard part, because, you know, I knew the disappointment was coming and most of the fun would be over. And he said, you don't have to worry. And so I knew a split second before the judge announced it, but not far enough in advance to take away that excitement. And I really could not believe what I was hearing when he said I'd won it.
I'm fascinated by your use of the word quirky, of that being a characterization of your own work, which seems to me that it's something you're comfortable with.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say they're not each and all quirky. You know, there are some that are longer, more traditional, very right. serious, not even funny, and go into very different territory. But then you have the two-line ones that have some odd message about a ladybug or a geographical confusion. And those I would call quirky, unexpected, and odd. You know?
That craft, as I mentioned in the introduction, of the extremely short story, how did you come to that?
I started by writing more traditional short stories that were a more conventional length and had all the conventional ingredients, the dialogue and the setting and the character development. And I worked hard at that. I think I learned a lot from doing that for several years. But then I realized that there was an alternative that I'd been reading Beckett and Kafka, but I hadn't really thought that I could do what they were doing. And then I realized I could, and felt a great liberation when I suddenly started writing the paragraph-long stories. They're much more nimble. You can go anywhere, and you can go anywhere quickly, and you can stop quickly. And I just found they were very versatile and enjoyable.
The idea of stopping quickly, does that add to the jolt for you as the writer, but especially for us as the reader?
Probably. I mean, if you stop before, you become predictable. If you stop before the reader says, oh, okay, I know where this is going, I know how it's going to end. I think it's sort of like, what is it like? It's like like kicking a ball and the ball goes on rolling, that in the reader's mind, something goes on happening, even though the story's over.
Well, that idea that has sort of been drilled into us as always leave them wanting more, that works for you in this regard.
I suppose. I mean, I don't do it deliberately. I don't think, you know, how can I make the reader want more? Although I do think that deliberately when I'm planning a public reading. I'm careful not to go on too long. But writing it, I'm just responding to the demands of the material itself, I think.
The idea of minimal in the words and having a sentence or two or a paragraph as the story, for word choice, does that make it even more important to you, or is it simply the words are the words and what works for you, and it would be that case if it was five pages?
I think in a way, the answer is both, because I'm just as careful when it's five pages or when it's the one novel that I wrote. I was just as careful. But it's definitely true that the shorter the piece is, the more each word matters. And if the piece is only, you know, I haven't done a count to see how many words the shortest piece is, but I'm sure that some are only 17 words or 13 words. It's definitely true that each word counts more than...
And it doesn't mean that it necessarily took less time to write.
Not necessarily, although inevitably the shortest ones took less time. I mean, it's true most of the time. Mm-hmm. Because the longest ones, I go over and over and over every paragraph and every sentence. And, you know, like cooking a recipe for eight people instead of two, as I recently found out. You can grate the zucchini for two people, and it takes less time than for eight people. But sometimes with the very shortest ones, they're not really finished, and I don't know how to finish them. So even if it's only two lines and a title, it's not quite right. And I do keep coming back to that over and over and over again, even though it's so short, until I get it.
So now the hardest question, I would think, to answer, or at least to put into words, is... So that idea of getting it, when you know that it's complete, when you know that you have it right.
That is hard. It is hard because in each story, it's a different problem. Some are pretty much right from the beginning, and I just need to smooth out a little bit of this or that or cut a little bit here or there. Others have, say, a very lame ending, an ending that just drops off, but without any very interesting impact. And I have to say, what's wrong here? You know, it's all the rest of it's fine, but there's something wrong. And that sometimes takes a long time of rewriting the end in case it's just the way I wrote it, or rethinking the actual content and saying, well, I didn't really get anything in the content. I have to think it through a bit more. But it's almost a gut feeling of a sense that it's whole, that there's nothing weak or flabby. It's almost a physical sense of the story that tells me if it's done or not.
Lydia Davis is the author of the new story collection, Can't and Won't. It is published by FSG. I'm hoping you can read one of your dream stories. It's called In the Train Station.
Yes, I'd be happy to. In the Train Station. The train station is very crowded. People are walking in every direction at once, though some are standing still. A Tibetan Buddhist monk with shaved head and long, wine-colored robe is in the crowd looking worried. I am standing still, watching him. I have plenty of time before my train leaves because I have just missed a train. The monk sees me watching him. He comes up to me and tells me he is looking for track number 3. I know where the tracks are. I show him the way.
And that is from the dream section. I'm curious as to how that would differ if it had really happened to you.
Well, it actually did happen to me. So it's one of the waking experiences that seemed to me like a dream. And I think it seemed to me like a dream because there I was standing still. There he was in his slightly exotic costume standing still in Penn Station with the crowd sort of swirling around us. And I knew the way, and he needed to know the way. So I became his, not spiritual instructor, but it certainly has that metaphorical feeling to it. So the whole thing had the air of a dream to me, and I was in the midst of writing these dream pieces. So, of course, it instantly came to mind as a dream. And I think what makes it sound more like a dream, at least to me, is the lack of circumstantial material. I don't say, you know, I was about to take a train up the Hudson River to go here or there. I leave it sort of an unknown train station and an unknown crowd and an unknown person, the way dreams are so often mysteriously unknown or mixed in their identities.
And it seems to me that we can relate to it because we all have those moments where we are in such a setting and such a place, especially as random as a train station or even an airport, and we focus on one individual for whatever reason, and in this case probably because of the specificity of the wardrobe.
Yes, and I had plenty of time, but I do have a habit of standing around in train stations observing people, because in a travel situation everybody is so preoccupied with getting where they're going and getting their tickets that they don't pay much attention to someone who's watching. So it's enjoyable. Yeah, I think it does resonate with people because of people having had that experience.
And there's also a surface element to it of you see the person, they're looking for directions, you help them. What often happens when you are alone and watching people is that you try to figure out perhaps what their situation in life, what brought them to that train station, what brought them to that particular track at that particular time. You usually don't go into that depth.
In my stories in general?
Right.
Yeah, but I certainly do it in my own mind all the time. I was almost trained in it, in the sense that my father had all the immense curiosity about people, even though he was an English literature professor. So we would be, and we did a lot of traveling, so we would be standing around and he would often say, you know, I wonder what their relationship is. So I do that reflexively. You know, they're getting along well, but I can't tell if they're husband and wife or brother and sister, and I really want to know.
And could you write about that to either give that some definition or to explore the very question that is rattling around in your mind?
I think I have probably touched on that sort of thing, but not in great depth, just in passing, you know, she wondered what their relationship was, you know, sort of thing, just in passing.
How do you believe your work has grown and matured?
I think probably, I know it hasn't sort of grown and matured in one form, obviously, you know, starting with a beginner's novel and coming to a mature novel. But I think I'm probably more sure about the words that occur to me to put down on the page. I think there's a lot less, there's a lot of close revision, but it would be in terms of, you know, in one tiny space of one sentence rather than having to do a lot of cutting, a lot of rewriting, a lot of insertions. And I think I probably have a more sure sense of what the form of a piece is going to be, how long it's going to be, and what sort of piece it'll be.
Do you ever flirt with poetry?
Well, I think a lot of the pieces are flirting with poetry. I mean, I think as soon as you get very short and as soon as the language gets a little poetic, meaning lyrical, imagistic, you are edging over into poetry. And certainly some of the pieces I deliberately thought of as poems, even though I don't consider myself a poet. And I would never, some prose writers publish a volume of their poetry. I would never do that. I just like to sort of mix it in, cross the line.
I would like you to read one of the stories called The Washerwoman. But before we do and start to close out, it is a story from Flaubert. What brought you down that path of exploring Flaubert?
Well, I was working on the translation of Madame Bovary, and I was reading Flaubert's letters. And every now and then I would come upon a very nice, self-contained little story he was telling to his correspondent. And I thought, these are sort of wasted, or not wasted, but buried here in the letters. They're almost lost. Unless you read French and you're reading all his letters patiently, you're not going to find them. So I had the idea, especially since I was not writing much of my own then, I was mainly translating. I had the idea of taking them out and doing to them what I would not do in a straight translation, but shape them and change the sentences a little bit if I thought they needed to be. And it was very delightful. It was finding a little gem in a pile of dirt, you know.
And it's much different, obviously, than translation, because you get to work in a way with Flaubert.
Yes, it is different. I'm a very faithful translator. So if he did something clumsy or awkward or displeasing, I would go right along with it because I would feel that that was the right thing to do. But with these stories, I could stop them when I wanted to. I even combined two stories that he told. And I even threw in a little detail taken from Madame Bovary that wasn't in the letters. So I didn't feel I had to be as faithful, although I still acknowledge them as mainly Flaubert's stories.
So this particular story is The Washerwomen, and a story from Flaubert.
Yes, this was The Washerwomen. This was one of the ones I came to later, and it's one of my favorites. The Washerwomen. Yesterday, I went back to a village 2 hours from here that I had visited 11 years ago with good old Orlovsky. Nothing had changed about the houses or the cliff or the boats. The women at the washing trough were kneeling in the same position, in the same numbers, and beating their dirty linen in the same blue water. It was raining a little, like the last time. It seems at certain moments as though the universe has stopped moving, as though everything has turned to stone, and only we are still alive. How insolent nature is. I think what I really like about that story, or one of the things, is right in the middle, the image beating their dirty linen in the same blue water. That the blue just jumps out at me, and of course, that's in Flaubert.
It's beautiful.
I love that. I think probably also because I've seen those stone troughs in France. It's very easy to imagine it. Also, he has a pattern when he tells a story in his letters. He tells the story and then he backs away a step and comments on it, philosophizes for a moment, and then he often ends with an exclamation like, "How insolent nature is." One of the stories he ends with, "Oh, Shakespeare." And it's not clear what he really means by "Oh, Shakespeare."
Do you think consciously about your own pattern, or do you try to avoid a pattern?
In an individual story, I don't think about it consciously, certainly in the first draft. I may have a general sense of how, you know, whether it's going to be like one unbroken breath, you know, rushing from beginning to end, or is it going to be stuttering and stopping and starting? I'll have a sense of that. It's very dangerous to stop and plan, so I'll just go ahead and write it and then try to look at it and see, you know, what's going on here and what needs to be changed a little bit.
The latest collection is Can't and Won't. It is published by FSG. Lydia Davis, it's always a delight to have you with us. I thank you so much for sharing time.
It was very enjoyable.
Great pleasure. Again, the title of the book is Can't and Won't Stories. It is published by FSG. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.